This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine for this, the week of March the 24th. I'm Charlie Van Sant. As always, it's better when you stop by. Up top, Baltimore lost more than a bridge. Looking out from the harbor used to be an exercise in optimism. This is by Rachel Gutman Y. You can see the Francis Scott Key Bridge from Fort McHenry, the Pentagon-shaped keep that inspired the bridge's namesake to write the verses that became our national anthem. You could see it from the pagoda in Patterson Park, another strangely geometric landmark from which I've cheered on teams at Baltimore's annual kinetic sculpture race. You could see it from the top of Johns Hopkins Hospital, the city's biggest employer. This morning, my husband sent me a photo of the familiar view out of his window at work, now dominated not by the soaring bridge, but by a hulking container ship halted in the middle of the water, with metal strewn over and around it. Videos of the bridge's collapse are stunning. At about 1:30 a.m., the ship called the Dally lost power and crashed into one of the bridge's central pillars. Within 15 seconds, the straight line of the bridge's span bends and breaks, and the entire structure tumbles into the harbor. The bridge was one of only three roadways crossing Baltimore's defining waterways, and until that morning, each of these routes served its own purpose. The I-95 tunnel, which cuts across the mouth of the harbor, was for people commuting between Baltimore and Washington, D.C. The famously congested Baltimore Harbor Tunnel, part of I-895, passes beneath the Patapsco River and was for people bypassing the city completely. The Key Bridge, farther down the river toward the Chesapeake Bay, handled the least traffic of the three, but it was part of the Baltimore Beltway, the circular highway that forms the unofficial boundary of the Baltimore metro area and shuttles suburbanites into the city to help make a run. Of the three routes, the Key Bridge was the most visible and beautiful, standing alone above the water in a long, graceful arch. Officials had enough notice of the Dally's distress that it blocked cars from entering the bridge before its collapse. But Maryland's transportation secretary told reporters that the department was searching for six missing construction workers who may have fallen into the 48-degree water. The crew was working to fix potholes to keep Baltimore's beat-up roads in good enough shape to keep traffic flowing into the city. Two workers have already been pulled from the water, one of whom was in such bad shape that they couldn't be asked what happened. As of about 10:08 a.m., no one but the construction crew was believed to have fallen into the water, but had the collapse happened a few hours later, hundreds of people might well be dead. On average, about 31,000 cars and trucks cross the bridge every day. And sort of a postscript here, as of Wednesday, it is now a recovery operation. The other workers have not been found and are presumed dead. The cars for now can be rerouted, but the remnants of the bridge, not to mention the Dally, are blocking the city's waterways for any other ships that are scheduled to enter. Baltimore is now America's 17th biggest port by tonnage, a respectable rank if a far cry from the early days of the United States when shipping made the city the third most populous in the country, and may well drop further down the list if the harbor remains inaccessible. Maryland Governor Wes Moore has yet to comment on when the port might reopen for business, but Baltimore is a city defined by water. The Gwynns Falls and the Jones Falls trickle through our parks. The Inner Harbor is our Times Square. Our economy is tied up in trade and transportation. Ships are in the city's bones. The brackish harbor is in its heart. Baltimore is also a city that can't catch a break, full of people who find joy in its absurdities. The Trash Wheel family, a set of four solar and hydro-powered googly-eyed machines that keep litter in the city's rivers from entering the harbor, are local celebrities. Every week, a group of magnet fishers meets at the harbor to pluck benches, scooters, and other treasures from the water, proudly displaying their haul along the sidewalk. Every year, bicycle-powered moving sculptures shaped like dragons and dogs and fire trucks compete to paddle down a short stretch of the harbor without capsizing. But no one ever really forgets that the harbor itself is visibly polluted, that much of the city's infrastructure is breaking and broken, that the state has held back funding to fix it, that Baltimore's mayoral administrations have been riddled with corruption, that people are still getting by on too little, that the murder rate is still too high. Baltimore Harbor is one of the city's most important links to the rest of the world. To cut it off is to clog our blood supply. Moore has already said that the bridge will be rebuilt to honor this morning's victims. We can still get out of the city with trains and cars, but this morning Baltimore feels that much more claustrophobic. Looking out toward the Chesapeake used to be an exercise in optimism, in feeling all the possibilities of being connected to the wider world and the terrifyingly wide swell of the Atlantic. Today, it's an exercise in mourning and resolve. Rachel Gutman Y. is a supervisory senior associate editor at The Atlantic. And you're listening to The Atlantic Magazine for this, the week of March the 24th. I'm Charlie Van Sant. Hi there, good to see you. Next up, an article by David A. Graham. What was NBC even thinking? Hiring Ronna McDaniel as a contributor angered the network's contributors, staff, and audience, and with seemingly no upside. And again, this is authored by David A. Graham. An old journalism axiom says that if everyone's mad at you, you must be doing something right. Since NBC announced that it had hired Ronna McDaniel, the recently deposed chair of the Republican National Committee, as a paid contributor, everyone's been mad. NBC executives are sure to be consoling themselves that they're doing something right. On Sunday, Meet the Press host Kristen Welker rightly raked McDaniel over her past election denialism. Chuck Todd, Welker's predecessor at NTP, then said the network's bosses owed her an apology for placing her in a tough position. He said he didn't know whether to take McDaniel's answers as honest. There's a reason why there are a lot of journalists at NBC News uncomfortable with this, because many of our professional dealings with the RNC over the last 6 years have been met with gaslighting, have been met with character assassination, Todd said on the air. Then on Morning Joe, the titular Scarborough said, "We weren't asked our opinion of the hiring, but if we were, we would have strongly objected to it for several reasons." Co-host Mika Brzezinski said she hoped that NBC would reconsider. If NBC on-air personalities were the only ones who were upset, that wouldn't mean the McDaniel hire was bad per se. It might even be the nice demonstration of editorial courage. She's hardly the first political hack to get a TV gig. Just ask MSNBC host Jen Psaki, a former White House press secretary, or ABC's George Stephanopoulos, a former White House communications director. Seeing such tourists over a Republican hire, even as former Democrats pepper TV sets, has a whiff of hypocrisy, though, as Todd points out, the blood between the Trump GOP and journalists has been much worse than the normal partisan jostling. Now, I'm going to pause here for a moment to explain tourists. It's actually a Jewish word. It means distress. I know that sometimes The Atlantic uses some $12 words, and I think sometimes it's good to find the definition. I didn't even know what that meant, so I looked it up. Anyway, the problem is that McDaniel has no apparent value to viewers or the network. When outlets hire figures like her, they typically say these people add perspective and insight that only insiders can provide. It couldn't be a more important moment to have a voice like Ronna's on the team, the NBC political editor Carrie Budoff Brown said in a statement. When CBS hired former White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney in 2022, an executive bluntly told staffers that the network expected Republicans to capture Congress in that year's midterm elections and that Mulvaney would assist in getting access, in quotes. Semaphore's Ben Smith has a related theory for this year. Many corporate leaders seem to have concluded that Donald Trump will win the presidential election, and so they're trying to make moves to get in his good graces. The problem is that McDaniel falls short both as an editorial offering and as favor currying. She spent more than 7 years as chairman of the RNC, but prior to that had only a short stint as a party chair. Her management of the national party was undistinguished. Republicans consistently underperformed in elections on her watch, including in 2022. The group enters the 2024 election cycle with its fundraising lagging behind the Democrats and with chaos at the state level. McDaniel is not known for her strategic acumen or ideological fervor. She was chosen for the job for loyalty to Trump and then discarded later when that loyalty proved insufficient. McDaniel's credibility is also in question. As Welker pointed out, she spent years indulging Trump's claims that the 2020 presidential election was stolen and the January 6 insurrectionists were patriots. McDaniel's explanation was not reassuring. When you're the RNC chair, you kind of take one for the whole team, right? Now I get to be a little bit more myself, right? This is what I believe. In other words, trust me, I was lying. All of this makes it hard to take McDaniel's on-air political commentary all that seriously. Still, if she's getting NBC entree into Republican circles where the mainstream press has struggled to penetrate, that could still be worthwhile. But is she? There are three kinds of prominent Republicans. Those who are in Trump's good graces, those who have been cast out of Trump's good graces, and those who have always loathed Trump. The third group has no truck with McDaniel, whom they see as a sycophantic sellout. They noted that she dropped her maiden name, Romney, in deference to Trump's disdain for her uncle. McDaniel herself is in the second group. She was available for the NBC gig because Trump demanded her removal as RNC chair, after all. The Trump loyalists in the first group have no affection for McDaniel either. A top campaign official crowed to Politico's playbook about her getting caught in the crossfire. No one in Trump's current orbit will want to appear close to McDaniel for fear of being cast out themselves. If Trump wins the election, McDaniel won't be able to speak very effectively to his inner circle, and if he loses, she won't be a credible voice in a post-Trump era of Republican politics. This leaves McDaniel without any constituency. Her hire offended NBC News journalists. No liberal viewers will like seeing her, and some MSNBC hosts have already ruled out booking her. Neither MAGA Republicans nor the establishment rump will accept her. This is a devilish moment for news organizations. Outlets that seek to understand Trump and his movement, even those that are very critical, want to find voices that represent them. But finding people who are still connected to Trump and can also speak with intellectual honesty is exceedingly difficult, if not inherently impossible. The McDaniel fiasco shows NBC hasn't solved the puzzle yet. And David A. Graham is a staff writer at The Atlantic and a postscript. As you may have read on Tuesday, NBC walked back its hiring of Ronna McDaniel. Whether or not she still gets her $300,000 salary, well, I guess we'll have to look at the contract. But Ronna McDaniel and NBC have parted ways as of Tuesday. And you're listening to The Atlantic Magazine for this, the week of March the 24th. I'm Charlie Van Sant. Always glad when you drop by. Up next in politics, the Supreme Court is shaming itself. No good legal reason exists to delay Donald Trump's January 6th trial any further. This is by Andrew Weissman and Ryan Goodman. Donald Trump is determined to avoid accountability before the general election, and So far, the U.S. Supreme Court is helping him. Trump has no legal ground whatsoever to delay a ruling in his plea for presidential immunity. The reason Trump has nevertheless sought to slow down the immunity appeals process is obvious. To postpone the trial date, hopefully pushing it into a time when, as president, he would control the Department of Justice and thus could quash the prosecution altogether. The Supreme Court has shamed itself by being a party to this when the sole issue before the court is presidential immunity. By contrast, Special Counsel Jack Smith has both law and policy on his side in seeking a prompt determination on immunity and a speedy trial soon thereafter. Yet the court has ignored all that. The Supreme Court's lollygagging is reflected in its scheduling the immunity case for a leisurely April 25th hearing. It's too late to do anything about that now, but the court has an opportunity to correct course following oral argument. The justices should press Trump's counsel on what possible legitimate reason he has to oppose a speedy resolution of the appeal and when they should rule with dispatch. And then they should rule with dispatch because there is still time, albeit barely, to vindicate the public's right to a speedy trial. Let's recap how we arrived at this present moment. After Judge Tanya Chutkan ruled against Trump's claim of presidential immunity on December 1st, and Trump appealed that ruling to the D.C. Circuit, Smith asked the Supreme Court to hear the appeal immediately, leapfrogging the delay of the circuit-level argument and decision. Trump opposed that, and the Supreme Court declined Smith's invitation. The Circuit Court expedited its appeal, and on February 6 issued its decision, again rejecting Trump's immunity argument in toto. Trump then sought a stay in the Supreme Court and advocated various measures to slow the court's hearing of the case. The Supreme Court then deliberated for a couple of weeks before accepting the case for review and not scheduling the argument until 2 months later. On the very last day of oral arguments for this session. Were he not seeking to avoid any trial in advance of the general election so he could maximize the chances of becoming the next president of the United States, Trump would have an interest in a speedy resolution of the immunity question, in contrast to the foot-dragging positions he has advocated throughout the litigation of this issue. Anyone with a legitimate claim of immunity has every interest in not suffering a single day more under the opprobrium of multiple criminal charges, not to mention being under pre-trial bail conditions and a gag order. Trump's lawyers have argued against his existing gag order, saying it sweeps so broadly as to undermine their client's ability to campaign for the presidency. The law itself recognizes the need for speed on this issue. With questions of immunity, courts permit an appeal in advance of a trial and forego the usual rule that appeals are permitted only after a verdict is reached. The hope in allowing for this is to relieve someone from the opprobrium and burden of a trial if the defendant is indeed immune. For the court to set such a prolonged schedule, antithetical to the appropriate time frame for the only issue actually before the justices, speaks volumes about the role the court has chosen to play in advancing the interests of the former president over the rule of law. The government has its own interests in seeking a prompt resolution of the immunity issue and a speedy criminal trial. And it has the same interest as a defendant in not subjecting someone to criminal charges who is immune from prosecution. But before delving into the government's interests, let's first dispense with a red herring. Special Counsel Smith is not disputing that Trump should be accorded sufficient time to prepare for trial. An inviolable constitutional safeguard is that all criminal defendants must be able to exercise their procedural rights to prepare. Judge Chutkan already weighed the parties' competing claims. Her decision on a trial date fell well within the mark for similar cases, and that ruling is not on appeal, despite the Supreme Court's behaving as if it were. The district judges selected timeline 7 months from the August 1 indictment in a case whose facts and substantial evidence were already available to the defendant, was longer than deadlines set all around the country. By way of comparison, next door in the more conservative Virginia district, defendants routinely go to trial at great speed without conservative commentators going to the barricades over alleged violations of the rights of the accused. That Trump is a rich, white, and politically powerful man does not mean he should be accorded more or fewer rights than others. And Chutkan has said that when the case returns to her, she will give Trump more time to prepare. With Trump's rights intact, then, Smith has several legitimate grounds for the immunity appeal to be decided expeditiously and a trial to start as promptly as possible. DOJ internal policy prohibits taking action in a case for the purpose of choosing sides in or affecting the outcome of an election. That is unquestionable and not in dispute here. Rather, the point is that well-established neutral criminal justice principles support a speedy trial. This trial's outcome, of course, is not known in advance, and it may lead some voters to think better or worse of the defendant and the current presidential administration, depending on the evidence and the outcome. Moreover, the public has a profound interest in a fair and speedy trial. As Justice Samuel Alito wrote for a unanimous Supreme Court, the Speedy Trial Act was designed not just to benefit defendants, but also to serve the public interest. The refrain that justice too long delayed is justice denied has unmistakable resonance in this criminal context. The special counsel's briefs in the D.C. case are replete with references to this well-settled case law. This means that even when the accused is seeking to delay his day in court, that does not alter the prosecutor's obligation to see to it that the case is brought on for trial, as the Supreme Court has well articulated. Many defendants seek to avoid the day of reckoning, hence Edward Bennett Williams' famous quip that for the defense, an adjournment is equivalent to an acquittal. The law provides that the public, the prosecution, and most emphatically the courts need not oblige that stratagem. What's more, when a defendant seeks to postpone a trial until a point at which he can no longer be prosecuted, the Justice Department may request the trial be held before that deadline. The DOJ's interest in deterrence and accountability warrants this action. If Trump should win the election, he will become immune as president from criminal trial for at least 4 years and perhaps forever by seeking dismissal of the federal case with prejudice or testing the efficacy of granting himself a pardon. The Justice Department can accordingly uphold the public interest in deterrence and accountability by seeking the prompt conviction of the leader of an insurrection. This DOJ need not advance the goals of a future administration led by that very oath-breaking insurrectionist. Another objective of criminal punishment is specific deterrence, ensuring the defendant herself does not commit offenses in the future. Given the grand jury's determination that Trump committed felonies to try to interfere with the 2020 election, there are strong law enforcement reasons to obtain a conviction to specifically deter Trump. Indeed, in proposing a trial date to Judge Chutkan, Smith quoted Justice Alito on behalf of the whole court that speedy trials serve the public interest, preventing extended pretrial delay from impairing the deterrent effect of punishment. Trump's public denigration of the legal system, the incessant claims that the criminal case is a witch hunt, also gives a nation committed to the rule of law a vital interest in holding a public trial where a jury can assess Trump's actions. Trials can thus serve to restore faith in the justice system. It is worth noting that when the government seeks its day in court, it simultaneously affords the defendant his day in court, providing him more process, not less. Indeed, the Department of Justice's so-called 60-day rule, which generally forbids it from taking overt actions in non-public cases with respect to political candidates and closely related people right before an election, is there to avoid a federal prosecutor hurling untested new allegations against a political candidate precisely because he would not have time to clear his reputation before the election. Here, the government is seeking to provide just that forum for Trump to clear his name before the election to test the criminal allegations against the highest legal standard we have for adjudicating facts. And yet right-wing critics attack Smith. Trump, of course, wants to avoid that test, but that is an interest the courts should abjure. The justices still have time to get back on track. Trump's claim that presidents have absolute immunity should be an easy issue to resolve, given these criminal charges. Whether a president should have criminal immunity in some specific circumstances is an abstract question for another day, because efforts to stay in office and use the levers of the presidency are certainly not those specific circumstances. The appeals have delayed matters long enough at the expense of the right of the American people to a fair and speedy trial. Let them not stand in the way of ever having a trial at all. Andrew Weissman is a professor at NYU School of Law. He is co-author of the new book, The Trump Indictments, and co-host of the podcast, Prosecuting Donald Trump. Ryan Goodman is a professor at NYU School of Law and co-editor-in-chief of Just Security. And that's going to wrap it up for the Atlantic Magazine for this, the week of March the 24th. I'm Charlie Van Sant. As always, it's better when you're here. And I'll look forward to speaking with you again next week.